Chapter 35. Arise and Thresh. The science of Christianity comes with fan in hand to separate the chaff from the wheat. Mary Baker Eddy, 1906. Sybil Wilbur called on Alfred Farlow to tell him of her conversation with the McClure's editor. She was greatly perturbed by all of the malicious gossip that Georgine Melmine had been collecting for 3 years, and told Mr. Farlow that she intended to collect information to refute all the lies. Quote, "You can't do it, Miss Wilbur," he said. "Even I couldn't do it. People refuse me information, sneer at me, falsify, tell long imaginary stories. They hate Mrs. Eddy because they once knew her in humbler circumstances. They envy and despise her work. No, you cannot do it." End quote. To this, Miss Wilbur replied, quote, "You mean you cannot, nor any other Christian Scientist. But I can, because I am a trained reporter and interviewer, and can truthfully say I am not a member of her church. I will find some magazine to finance me, some poor little magazine that will be glad to give me a stipend to go on. You will see, I will get the truth, and the truth will be better than gossip in the end." End quote. Miss Wilbur did follow through on this proposed action, but almost before she had begun, and before McClure's published their first derogatory article, the New York World came out with a second attack. This was a two-part article published on November 4th and 5th, entitled, quote, "How Reverend Wiggin Rewrote Mrs. Eddy's Book," end quote. James Henry Wiggin had passed away 6 years earlier, but numerous letters from people who had known and talked with him began arriving in Boston and at Pleasant View, refuting these new lies. Alfred Farlow also wrote a refutation, which was published in the New York American, but Mrs. Eddy immediately wrote a letter to that publication, correcting Mr. Farlow. Mr. Alfred Farlow's flimsy article in the New York American needs correction. It was a great mistake to say that I employed Reverend Henry Wiggin to correct my diction. It was for no such purpose. I engaged Mr. Wiggin so as to avail myself of his criticisms of my statement of Christian Science, which criticisms would enable me to explain more clearly the points that might seem ambiguous to the reader. This letter was a jolt to Mr. Farlow, and when he read it, he wrote to the leader, "The affair may reflect on my reputation for being able to state facts about our beloved leader, but that is more than compensated by the fact that this letter emphatically shows who is conducting the Christian Science Church." Farlow had been named by the New York World as one of the designing Christian Scientists controlling Mrs. Eddy and her money, along with Calvin Frye, Louis Strang, and several others. On the day Farlow wrote to Mrs. Eddy, he also wrote to Louis Strang. "You can imagine my surprise and chagrin to find our beloved leader's letter in the New York American. I have thought all the while that Wiggin actually undertook to help her diction. I believe now that she should see all of Wright's article so that she can see just what they are claiming." It may be that she did read all of what Livingston Wright had written for the New York World, before her refutation appeared in both Sentinel and Journal in December. Miscellany, page 317. But the leader did more than write this correction in this hour of persecution. On November 5th, she wrote to Henrietta Schonfrau, "Have six of your best students, loyal and truthful, take up every day with you, work mental, to sustain the cause, and do their duty to their leader and mother." Enclosed with this letter was an argument for transgressors, which began, quote, "One mind, truth controls all. You are set free in the love of God, and you cannot make nor believe a lie," end quote. This argument ended with, quote, "Divine mind governs every hour, and evil is powerless," end quote. The leader also amended a bylaw, which appeared in the Sentinel of November 10th. This amendment added to what is now Article 24, Section 9, Committee on Business, Manual, page 79. These two sentences: "There shall be a committee on business of one or more members wherever Mrs. Eddy resides. The members of these committees shall be paid from the church fund." She then appointed Reverend Tomlinson and his sister Mary, who lived together in their own house in Concord, as her local committee on business. In 1881, in an hour of anguish and exaltation, God had spoken to Mary Baker Eddy in these words, "And I will give to thee, daughter of Zion, a new heritage and a new people. O blessed daughter of Zion, I am with thee, and none shall take my words out of thy lips. Thou art my chosen, to bear my truth to the nations, and I will not suffer another messenger to go before thee. And I will lift thee up, O daughter of Zion, and I will make of thee a new nation for thy praise." In 1898, a verse which for 50 years had been forgotten was suggested to the leader's thought, and she had it inscribed over the entrance to Christian Science Hall. "Daughter of Zion, awake from thy sadness. Awake, for thy foes shall oppress thee no more. Bright o'er thy hills dawns the day star of gladness. Arise, for the night of thy sorrow is o'er." It would appear that following the vicious attacks of the world in the fall of 1906, that God spoke to Mrs. Eddy through Micah. Chapter 4, 11 through 13. "Now also, many nations are gathered against thee, that say, Let her be defiled, and let our eye look upon Zion. But they know not the thoughts of the Lord, neither understand they his counsel. For he shall gather them as the sheaves into the floor. Arise and thresh, O daughter of Zion, for I will make thine horn iron, and I will make thy hoofs brass, and thou shalt beat in pieces many people, and I will consecrate their gain unto the Lord, and their substance unto the Lord of the whole earth." On November 12th, the, quote, "daughter of Zion," end quote, wrote a letter with an accompanying article entitled "Harvest," to the Independent in New York, which was published with this editorial comment: In response to a request by the Independent, following the unfounded statements as to her illness, Mrs. Eddy has been good enough to send us this article, which we received in her own handwriting, and which shows none of the tremulous unevenness which often appears in the chirography of a person of her age, she being in her 86th year. We herewith reprint her accompanying letter, reproduced about 1/3. This is the first statement which Mrs. Eddy has made as to recent events, and it is probably the only one she will make. Editor. Then followed Mrs. Eddy's article, Harvest, Miscellany, page 269, which states in part, God hath thrust in the sickle, and he is separating the tares from the wheat. This hour is molten in the furnace of soul. Its harvest song is worldwide, world known, world great. The vine is bringing forth its fruit. The beams of right have healing in their light. The windows of heaven are sending forth their rays of reality. Even Christian Science pouring out blessing for cursing and rehearsing, quote, I will rebuke the devourer for your sakes, and he shall not destroy the fruits of your ground, end quote. The lie and the liar are self-destroyed. Let error rage and imagine a vain thing. Mary Baker Eddy is not dead, and the words of those who say that she is are the father of their wish. Those words of our dear departing Savior, breathing love for his enemies, fill my heart. Quote, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. End quote. What we love determines what we are. I love the prosperity of Zion, be it promoted by Catholic, Protestant, or by Christian Science. This message from the leader went round the world and healed and elevated many, many people, Christian Scientists and non-Christian Scientists alike. And it continues to heal and elevate people today. The leader was returning good for evil, blessing for cursing, as she always did. But she also knew the deadliness of the enemy in its wicked intent to destroy her, and the necessity for defense. Bliss Knapp was on a lecture tour, lecturing as far south and west as Los Angeles, California, which he had done in September. In November, Mrs. Eddy wrote to Bliss's father, Ira Knapp, write to Bliss to make no more engagements to lecture at present, but to return and remain in Massachusetts till our next annual meeting in June. There is a great need of such as he is in Christian Science to be in Boston. As soon as Bliss arrived in Boston, a little later in November, Mrs. Eddy wrote to him, Beloved Bliss, I am especially engaged now, hence cannot have the great pleasure of seeing you today. Will let you know when I can have this pleasure. I am glad that you are near us. You are needed here more than elsewhere. Boston and Concord are the garrisons which need to be armored and defended. In about 2 weeks, I hope to be with less on hand so that I can make an appointment with you to visit me in Pleasant View. Most tenderly, lovingly yours, Mary Baker Eddy. On the day she wrote to Bliss Knapp, she also wrote to Louis Strang, giving him an additional assignment. Can you take up strong, true, ceaseless, till Mother says stop, those sinning ones in our cause, who will not listen to the voice and the word of their leader and mother in Israel? They and they only give us all at Pleasant View to meet them much work. Thank him, dear student, and pray for our enemies. Do you know this means we have no enemies? Matthew 16, verse 4. Say nothing to Fry about this letter, but all this work add to what he gives you to do from me. Mother asks this added burden from her dear one, knowing, trusting in his faithfulness. Several days later, on December 3rd, she wrote to Mr. Strang again, stop the work now. Pleasant View is safe as any place in this world of sinning sense can be and survive. But Mother asks, when will faithful students waken to the hour, hear his voice, and recognize the trials of his cause? But a good deal more had transpired before she sent the second message to Louis to stop his extra work. On November 15th, another attack on Christian Science was published in a privately printed pamphlet entitled The Anarchy of Christian Science. The author was the rector of St. John's Episcopal Church in Northampton, Massachusetts, Lyman P. Powell. In his pamphlet, Mr. Powell advised, quote, every minister to make a serious study of Christian Science, and thus armed, fight it to the death, by public and by private words, end quote. This attack was considerably different from the others, for Powell was an earnest clergyman who was misled by the lies. The originators of the lies, plus a great many other newsmen, were seeking statements from all who had ever known Mrs. Eddy, as well as some of those nearest her. In addition to the malicious gossip, which was as invented, encouraged, and untrue as the cancer story, there were a great many truthful, supportive statements, including a great many from non-Christian scientists. One in this category was a letter of November 15th, which Calvin Fry received from his cousin, Judge N.P. Fry of Lawrence, Massachusetts. New York World reporters had sought Judge Fry to support their lies about his cousin, but he wrote Calvin, I told them of your good character, that I had known you ever since we were children and played together in good old Andover, that I had never caught you in a mean act, and that I did not believe you would do a wrong thing in your present position, and I am satisfied I told them correctly. Stand by Mrs. Eddy until the end, for she is a worthy woman. One point of interest during this hour of trial is that the representative from the Concord Monitor is the city editor Harlan C. Pearson, also the local Associated Press representative, rather than the editor, Mrs. Eddy's friend of many years, George H. Moses. Mr. Moses had issued a lengthy statement to the press refuting the lies of the world and telling the truth about Mrs. Eddy. But Mr. Moses's employer, the owner of the Concord Monitor, was ex-Senator William E. Chandler. By mid-November, if not earlier, the New York World had employed Senator Chandler to institute a suit at law against the revelator to this age and her cause. The most famous person residing in Concord, New Hampshire, was Mary Baker Eddy, and the second best known resident of that area was William Eaton Chandler. Senator Chandler had exerted a wide influence in political affairs. Michael Meehan wrote of him, "Mr. Chandler was known as an able lawyer. His power of sarcasm in the United States Senate has been rarely paralleled, never surpassed. He had proven his ability as a debater and pleader. He was adroit and tactful. He was rich in resources, and in the past he had won notoriety, if not fame, along political lines by converting absolute defeat into victory." The powers of this world were aiming a deadly blow at God's chosen witness, and the weapon of their warfare was the God of this world, money. Money of itself is inert, but the lust for money perverts the morally weak. A number of people had already been told that money was no object to name their price, and some had succumbed. In his book, Mrs. Eddy and the Late Suit in Equity, Michael Meehan says that, quote, "It is easy to believe that the world was the real party in interest, that it employed the council, and that it was the world's money that paid all bills," end quote. Mr. Meehan meant, of course, the New York world, but there is a broader connotation to his words. Both James Slott and William Chandler were adroit, persuasive, and cunning, and now they were working together to draw others into the web they were weaving to destroy Mary Baker Eddy. On the night of November 22nd, James Slott left New York City for Lead City, South Dakota, bearing two letters from Senator Chandler. By Wednesday, November 28th, James Slott had probably changed trains more than once on his way to Lead, South Dakota. On that day, Mrs. Eddy had asked one member of her household, Louis Strang, to do additional work, quote, "strong, true, ceaseless, till mother says stop," end quote. The next day, Thanksgiving Day, Mr. Slott disembarked at the railway depot in Lead and went directly to the George Glover House. After introducing himself and ascertaining that Mr. Glover was well aware of and favorably impressed by the well-known ex-senator from New Hampshire, he presented this letter. Washington, D.C., November 22nd, 1906. "My dear Mr. Glover, I have consented to act as legal counsel concerning certain questions which arise in connection with Mrs. Mary Baker G. Eddy. They are stated in a letter from me to Mr. Slott, who will call upon you and can show you my letter to him. It is important for public and private interests that these questions should be investigated and met and fairly and justly disposed of as questions involving doubts, which from large and commendable motives, all good citizens and especially all relatives of Mrs. Eddy should help to solve and settle. Therefore, please be sure and give Mr. Slott a full hearing and possess yourself fully of all the facts which he will be able to give you. Very respectfully, William E. Chandler." Probably George retired to another room to study this letter, as was his custom, for he was illiterate. His daughter Mary acted as his secretary. The second letter Slott had brought was designed for Mr. Glover's consumption, though cleverly not written to him. "My dear Mr. Slott, I consent to act as counsel concerning certain questions which arise in connection with Mrs. Mary Baker G. Eddy. It seems clear that there are several doubts about several points. 1. Mrs. Eddy may be detained in the custody of strangers against her will. 2. She may be so nearly worn out in body and mind as a confirmed invalid that she is incapable of deciding any questions whatever according to any will or pleasure of her own, and necessarily, therefore, incapable of managing her business and property affairs. 3. Being thus restrained or incapable, or without relatives near her, she may be surrounded by designing men, who either have already sought, or may hereafter seek, to wrongfully possess themselves of her large property, or induce her to make a disposition of it, contrary to what would be her sane and deliberate intentions, if she were in perfect possession of her liberty and mental faculties. These doubts have arisen in connection with investigations recently made. Beyond all questions, steps should be taken to solve the doubts, to correct the wrong if it exists, and to establish the right in every respect. This new work should be done, if possible, in cooperation with Mrs. Eddy's son or any other relative who may be impressed with his duties in this regard. And if the relatives do not move, it should be done by such right-minded citizens as are in sympathy with the commendable movement. Yours truly, William E. Chandler. Chandler had carefully said, quote, maybe, end quote. For he, as well as all of Concord, knew these allegations were not true. Evil always claims that its actions are, quote, to correct the wrong and to establish the right in every respect, end quote. The World reported that an agent placed before Glover, quote, his legal opportunity, end quote. It had also reported Mrs. Eddy's property at $15 million, 15 times its actual value. But it took more than this persuasion to enlist George Glover in their camp. If Slott had expected to find a disaffected or estranged son, he was surprised, for George Glover was fiercely loyal to both his mother and Christian Science, although he had little understanding of either. The youngest child, George III, who was 17 years old in 1906, was locked out of, quote, much vigorous argument behind closed doors, end quote, which went on for several days. For many years, George Glover had retained the services of an upstanding attorney, James P. Wilson, but Mr. Wilson had moved to Denver 3 years earlier, and Mary Glover had become advisor to her father, as well as his secretary. Mrs. Eddy knew that her son was extremely suggestible and easily persuaded. A neighbor, who knew the Glover family well, stated in later years that both Mr. Glover and his daughter were gullible, but she believed that Mary was even more gullible than her father. Slott found that George had long been antagonistic to Calvin Fry, feeling that he kept him from his mother, which he may well have done in line of duty. So Fry became the villain, leading a group of unscrupulous, power-hungry, money-hungry men surrounding his mother, and Chandler was the knight in shining armor who would rescue her. When Slot left Lead, the Glovers were totally deceived and remained so for the rest of their days. On Thanksgiving Day, when James Slot was calling on the Glovers, Mrs. Eddy was calling her household metaphysical workers together for her usual daily talk with them. This day, before finishing, she asked each what he had to be thankful for. Fry recorded in his diary that Lewis Strang had answered, quote, for the sense of suffering, end quote. Then he recorded the leader's commendation of this answer. Quote, she told him his answer was the nearest right of any we gave, for mortal sense in all its phases is a lie, and the sense of suffering is the nearest out of mortal sense. End quote. One more item of note occurred in November 1906, and that was the 419th edition of Science and Health. This is not the revised edition the leader is working on, but it is noteworthy because it is the first unnumbered edition. The last numbered editions were the 417th in cloth and the 418th in limp leather. Mr. Norwood had received further word from Mrs. Eddy regarding the testimonials he was selecting, titling, and arranging for this revision of fruitage. Another word to you, Mr. Norwood, CSD, beloved, if there is not enough new testimonials of the new ones to make out the 700 pages of Science and Health, you can retain some of the old testimonials that are now in this book. Be sure to have 700 pages in this edition, and if it overruns this a little in the makeup, no matter. But the original number must not be lessened. Instead of 2 weeks, Mr. Norwood worked for 6 weeks to complete this task. When the time had come to send proofs to Pleasant View, he received a sacredly confidential letter from the leader with explicit directions as to how this was to be done. In retrospect, Mr. Norwood wrote, "This letter was a most remarkable proof of her wonderful understanding of God and of the illusion of mortal mind and its so-called activities." In the letter she said, quote, "Let no one see this but your own dear self," end quote. And when I read it, I had such a glimpse of ineffable good and the supreme spiritual height that our God-crowned leader had attained. It was transcendental. God bless her. When the proofs arrived, another student began on his appointed task as final proofreader. That was the scholarly William D. McCracken. By the end of November, the plates, too, had been sent, and Mr. Norwood's mission was accomplished. The leader wrote to him on December 1st, "My beloved student, words are weak to express my gratitude for your strict demonstration and success in conveyance. Also, your fidelity in all entrusted to you. I was not mistaken in my man if I were in some men. My prayer is for all that learn through suffering and for all who learn by enjoying to enter into the rest of rightness. For every experience human is met, compensated or punished by divine love. Dear one, learn with me to have but one God, to know of no other mind. For this will bring peace and spare us the sorrow and agony that so-called mortal mind has in store. One mind, and loving others as we would be loved, is the panacea for all our wrongs, trouble, and strife. I hope sometime to reward you for your dear heart and your helping hand in my behalf. Give my love to Mrs. Norwood. Lovingly, gratefully yours, Mary Baker Eddy.